KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
We owe the American people the assurances that every dollar we are spending abroad is being spent on something that furthers our national interest.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio has announced that he is the current acting director of USAID.
For Monday, February 3rd, it's All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro, hosting from the edge of the Panama Canal. When President Trump talks about taking the canal back, people here remember the events of 1989.
That's when the U.S. ousted dictator Manuel Noriega.
It's important for me, for everybody, to also not to forget what happened, not to forget who we are, not to forget we fought for the canal, and now they want to take the canal back.
Also, how effective are Colorado's safety protocols for recreational marijuana?
I consider Colorado weed today to be on par with New York street weed in 2008.
And an NBA trade that has left basketball fans and sports writers aghast.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. After speaking for a second time today over the phone, President Trump and Canadian leader Justin Trudeau announced there is a 30-day pause on the 25% tariffs the U.S. was going to impose on Canada. As NPR's Deepa Shivram explains, it comes hours after word of a similar pause for Mexico.
President Trump posted on his social media platform that the tariffs on Canada, which were supposed to go into effect on Tuesday, would be paused to see if an economic deal between the two countries could be reached. Trudeau also shared the news on social media and said Canada would invest $1.3 billion to enforce the U.S.-Canada border to help stop the flow of fentanyl, though only a tiny percentage of fentanyl that comes to the U.S. is through the northern border. Tariffs on Mexico were also given a 30-day pause after Mexican leader Claudia Sheinbaum and Trump spoke, and Mexico agreed to beef up security on the southern border. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News, the White House.
President Trump, meanwhile, is acknowledging all his tough talk on tariffs and possible implementation could cause some pain for average Americans. Tariffs could spark inflation, according to economists. That would essentially violate a promise Trump made to voters when he promised to bring down inflation. Billionaire Elon Musk, under the auspices of the non-government entity Doge, continues to move to consolidate control over large swaths of the federal government. The world's wealthiest man working on behalf of President Trump, shutting down the U.S. Agency for International Development, which was created by Congress to provide international aid. Maryland Congressman Jamie Raskin was among those at a protest in Washington, D.C. against the administration's actions.
This is billions of dollars of work that is being done all over the world, and they're trying to disrupt it and block it. And it comes from Elon Musk, and we don't know exactly what authority he's operating under.
Trump administration has placed two top security officials at USAID on leave after they refused to turn over classified material. The White House maintains Musk is working for Trump as, quote, a special government employee. Recent fires in L.A. County left thousands of farm workers laboring in unhealthy air pollution. NPR's Nate Perez reports they have limited protections.
Smoke from the Hughes fire in late January quickly spread to Ventura County, where thousands of farm workers picked strawberries, citrus, and other produce. Nonprofits scrambled to get around 21,000 N95 respirators to people in the fields. Elizabeth Strader with the United Farm Workers says workers are concerned about their health, but have no choice but to work.
And there are long-term effects. You know, we know that it damages the heart. We know that it damages their lungs.
Employers in California are legally required to provide N95 respirators to workers when the air quality index reaches 150. Oregon and Washington are the only other states that also have this requirement. Nate Perez, NPR News.
The Dow dropped 122 points today. This is NPR. One of the industry's loudest voices against efforts to fight climate change has been confirmed as the nation's energy secretary. The Senate signing off on Chris Wright, head of Denver-based Liberty Energy, to lead the Department of Energy. Wright has said increased fossil fuel production can help lift people out of poverty. That's despite the ties between increased oil, natural gas, and coal production and planet-warming greenhouse gas emissions. Scientists say they've developed a device that uses pulses of electricity to treat rheumatoid arthritis. NPR's John Hamilton reports it could offer a way to reduce inflammation without drugs.
The implanted device delivers electrical pulses to the vagus nerve, which connects the brain with internal organs and the immune system. Dr. Kevin Tracy of Northwell Health in New York says the pulses trigger a reflex that puts the brakes on inflammation in joints.
Neural signals have the ability to reflexively control aspects of the immune system that, frankly, nobody had thought about before.
A study of 242 patients with rheumatoid arthritis found that the device, made by SetPoint Medical, was able to reduce pain and inflammation and slow the damage in affected joints. The Food and Drug Administration is reviewing the device and is likely to make a decision by the end of the year. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Dogs were lining up in San Francisco to get a shot to fight a highly contagious outbreak of parvovirus, which is contagious and can be fatal in some animals. Dog vaccinations are being offered through the SPCA and animal control in the city's Tenderloin neighborhood. About 100 dogs were expected today, and the SPCA says a second clinic will be added. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro in Panama.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Secretary of State Marco Rubio announced today that he is now the acting director of the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID. Rubio said that the agency needs to align with an America First foreign policy agenda.
We owe the American people the assurances that every dollar we are spending abroad is being spent on something that furthers our national interest.
Earlier today, billionaire Elon Musk said the so-called Department of Government Efficiency was in the process of shutting down USAID with approval from President Trump. NPR Global Health correspondent Fatma Tanis joins us now. Hi, Fatma.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so tell us exactly what Rubio's announcement means for the agency.
Well, Secretary Rubio said that he's been frustrated with USAID since he was in Congress, that the agency has an attitude that is, quote, independent of national interests. Now, for people who work for USAID, it's been a very chaotic couple of weeks. You know, first came Trump's order freezing all foreign aid, then a stop work order for all programs, including humanitarian assistance, distribution of medicine, vaccines. Now, at first, the administration said that it would be conducting a review of all of these programs and then deciding which ones they wanted to keep running. But today, Rubio said that the agency has not been cooperating. So there are still a lot of questions about what this announcement will mean for those programs and for agency staff.
Yeah. Okay, so what are you hearing from sources inside the agency?
Well, people are worried, depressed, shocked. I've been speaking to people inside the agency and also contractors. They didn't want to give their names because they're afraid of losing their jobs. Mm-hmm. And they've all said that they were working hard to adhere to the stop work order and the aid freeze, but that there's been very little guidance from administration officials. And I also spoke with a senior official at USAID who requested anonymity because they're not authorized to speak on behalf of the agency. And this person told me that people are willing to work with the administration on reforms. But what the administration is doing is not how you reform an agency, this person said. They said it's a hatchet job instead. And now thousands of employees have been laid off. People have been locked out of their computer systems. The agency website and social media accounts have been gone with no explanation. So USAID, as we knew it, doesn't exist right now.
I mean, it's been so sudden. Did anyone see this coming? Like, why do they think it's even happening?
Well, people told me they're shocked at the scale and the speed in which this has all happened, even though there were some signs during President Trump's first term that the agency was being politicized. I spoke with Susan Reichle. She's a former senior USAID official, and she said it started happening in April 2020.
There was a small group that all of a sudden were attacking USAID's work on gender, for example, working with democracy, human rights, and governance.
Now, Reichle and other USAID officials also told me that the agency is an easy target for the administration because its programs operate overseas, and Americans are less familiar with it than other federal agencies.
I mean, Fatma, is the Trump administration even allowed to do this, I mean, legally, without congressional approval?
So legal experts say the administration does have some leeway with taking the functions of USAID, delegating them to the State Department, for example. I spoke with Tess Bridgman. She's a former White House counsel under President Obama. But she says what's happening here with USAID goes far beyond that and definitely needs approval from Congress.
We should be concerned that this is an effort by the Trump administration to unilaterally remake the federal government without congressional authorization.
She says if this is what's happening with USAID, the question is which federal agency is going to be next.
That is NPR's Fatma Tanis. Thank you so much, Fatma.
Thank you.
When Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu visits the White House tomorrow, he'll be the first world leader to meet President Trump since his inauguration. Their meeting has a lot hanging in the balance: the future of Gaza, the wider Middle East, and Netanyahu himself. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Tel Aviv.
When American-Israeli hostage Keith Siegel was freed by Hamas this past weekend, his family and friends cheered, but they're worried about the next stage of the deal, freeing Israeli hostages for Palestinian prisoners. Rabbi Steve Bernstein.
We just hope and pray that the Americans do everything that they can to ensure that the Israeli government has the strength and the courage to make sure that we reach the second stage of the deal and that all of the hostages come home as soon as possible.
Negotiations for the second stage of the ceasefire began today. What happens next in Gaza is not the only major question Prime Minister Netanyahu faces. He spoke before leaving for Washington.
The decisions we made in the war have already changed the face of the Middle East. Our decisions and the courage of our soldiers have redrawn the map. But I believe that working closely with President Trump, we can redraw it even further and for the better.
President Trump wants the Gaza ceasefire to continue till all Israeli hostages are freed. But Netanyahu's right-wing governing partner, Bezalel Smotrich, has threatened to topple the government if Israel doesn't return to war in Gaza and destroy Hamas.
I think Netanyahu wants exactly what Trump offers him, but I think his own coalition has quite a different vision.
Hebrew University politics professor Gail Talshir.
That Tuesday meeting is actually critical to Netanyahu's ability to survive as the leader of Israel and to make sure that his coalition stays intact.
What Trump and Netanyahu really want is diplomatic relations between Israel and Arab heavyweight Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is demanding a pathway toward creating an independent Palestinian state. Netanyahu's government opposes a Palestinian state, calling it a threat after Hamas's deadly October 7th attack in 2023. Victoria Coates at the Heritage Foundation was a deputy national security advisor during Trump's first term when he also tried to broker this deal.
As much as we might want a deal with Saudi Arabia, you know, Israel is going to, particularly after October 7th, remain very, very mindful of its internal security. It has to. So you know, the deal that looked like it was pretty imminent in 2020, 2021 timeframe may take a little bit longer now.
Trump has also floated the prospect of relocating Palestinians from the devastated Gaza Strip to neighboring Egypt and Jordan. Arab countries, including Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia, have firmly rejected the idea, and Palestinians have too. At a rally in Tel Aviv, Israeli TV actor Lior Ashkenazi said, "Extremist forces at home will try to thwart the ceasefire deal and return to the war. This must not happen." In Washington, Netanyahu is going into a fateful meeting with Trump, expecting a smoother relationship than he had with President Biden, and trying to get on the same page after a tumultuous period of war. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
All right. right. The Grammy Awards were held last night in Los Angeles, and the biggest prizes of the night went to familiar names like Beyoncé and Kendrick Lamar. But NPR Music's pop critic Ann Powers says a different story caught her eye, a musical changing of the guard. Hi, Ann.
Hi, Elsa. How are you doing?
I'm good. So who were some of these performers that you want to highlight today?
Well, honestly, there were so many. The show is just packed with great performances by young artists who are also winning Grammys.
Yeah.
But two examples would be Sabrina Carpenter, who showed herself not only to be a great pop singer, but also a hilarious screwball comedian, and Chapel Roan, who blew everyone away with her mix of drag, glam, and new wave in the service of visionary queer politics.
Oh, yeah.
You know, here's the thing, Elsa. Pop stars embody their generation. And these young stars, they have the same self-confidence and insistent vision of Gen Z political activists or Instagram influencers. They have arrived on the scene fully formed.
I mean, I hear you, but doesn't this happen all the time? Like, isn't part of the job of the music industry to anoint new stars, right? Was there anything different about this year?
Well, yes, because usually there's like one breakthrough, you know? But what stood out for me this year was the sheer number of young stars who absolutely dominated, and also their confidence. I mean, this is the true arrival of Gen Z, that generation that grew up performing, you know? Everybody's been on screens forever, and they are so in command of their public image. Consider Doechii. You know, she's a genius young rapper, but she's also an auteur. She's a surrealist, like, say, the filmmaker Jordan Peele. she and her peers are poised, and they're uber confident. And they remind me of, honestly, Madonna in the 80s. They're like a whole bunch of Madonnas all at once.
I love that.
Here's Doechii accepting the Grammy Award for Best Rap Album.
Don't allow anybody to project any stereotypes on you that tell you that you can't be here, that you're too dark, or that you're not smart enough.
But let me ask you, Anne, I mean, didn't Taylor Swift also have a fast rise early on?
Well, you could think of Taylor Swift that way or Beyonce, but both of them took some time to find their footings at the Grammys. These new faces, the ones I mentioned, I mean, like backflipping rock star Benson Boone or country rebel Shaboozey, they are ready out of the gate. It's frankly time for millennials to accept their position as the older generation. That's what I got to say.
That is NPR Music's pop critic, Ann Powers. Thank you so much, Ann.
Thanks so much.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at amazonbusiness.com. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Tech billionaire Elon Musk was the biggest donor in last year's election, and now as head of President Trump's Doge team, his job is to slash government spending. The entity's actions are causing confusion and chaos at federal agencies and raising security and legal concerns. NPR's Shannon Bond covers Elon Musk. Shannon, catch us up. What are some of the things that Doge is doing already?
Well, Ari, as you may have heard, Musk says Doge is eliminating the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID. Late last night, Musk posted on his platform X, quote, "We spent the weekend feeding USAID into the wood chipper." And that's not all. Even though a lot of the details about Doge are still unclear, other news outlets have reported Musk's deputies there have gotten access to key systems throughout the U.S. government. That includes the system the Treasury Department uses to pay everything from Social Security and Medicare benefits to Americans' tax refunds, as well as access to personnel files on millions of federal workers.
Well, is all of this legal?
I mean, that is the big question. Now, on this USAID shutdown, Musk said in a live stream chat on his platform X last night that he does have Trump's backing to do this.
And I actually checked with him a few times, said, are you sure? I'm like, yes.
Now, on Monday, Trump was asked about whether dissolving USAID requires an act of Congress. He suggested that would not be necessary if the agency is what he described as, quote, an act of fraud. Democratic senators say it would require Congress's approval. And they, as well as, you know, many workers and former officials I've been speaking with, are very concerned about particularly these reports that Doge representatives are getting access to classified materials at USAID. None of this is normal, says Richard Painter, who is the government's chief ethics lawyer in the George W. Bush administration. He says, in particular, accessing sensitive data, shutting down building access, has not happened before.
I have never seen anything like this before. We do not have a RoboCop clause of the United States Constitution.
Well, Musk is the leader of Doge, but what can you tell us about who is actually carrying out this work?
Yeah, I mean, so let's start with Musk, actually. White House Press Secretary Caroline Levitt said today, Elon Musk is what's known as a, quote, special government employee. That's a temporary appointment to perform limited services. She said she does not have details about Musk's security clearance. And we don't know about the status of others working at Doge, like whether or not they are government employees, what clearances they may have. What we do know, Ari, is that some of these folks are young engineers who have come in from Silicon Valley. So, for example, an email sent early Monday morning to USAID staff about the building being closed in Washington today had the name of a former Twitter employee on it. His LinkedIn page describes him as a special advisor to the director at the Office of Personnel Management, which is essentially the federal government's HR department. But he now also has a USAID email address. So we just don't know about where these people are.
Has Musk responded to the criticism of what Doge is doing?
Well, he's been posting a lot on X today. He says Democrats who are protesting these moves, both at USAID and at Treasury, are, quote, corrupt. And Musk has made it clear he believes he has a mandate to cut what he sees as waste. But one of the big issues that all of this is hitting up against, Ari, is that it is Congress that has the power of the purse, right, that gets to decide spending. So what Doge is doing here with these sort of cuts, these sort of unilateral decisions about shutting down agencies, does seem to be a direct challenge to those powers that do reside with Congress.
Thank you. That's NPR's Shannon Bond.
Thank you.
Marijuana is now legal for recreational or medical use in 40 states, but it is still illegal federally. So every state has its own safety standards. And Colorado Public Radio's Ben Marcus reports that there's growing concern about molds and pesticides in marijuana.
Few people have consumed more types of marijuana than Thomas Mitchell. He reviewed strains for a weekly publication in Denver, everything from edibles to vapes. But he still prefers to smoke the green buds.
I definitely don't turn my nose away to any option out there. It's more about where it came from than what it is, but I'm still a flower guy. Nothing beats the afterwork bong hit.
Mitchell has also written about safety recalls of cannabis. Colorado authorities have issued nearly 100 health and safety warnings since 2016. Last year, Missouri recalled more than 100,000 products over faulty lab testing, and California recalled boxer Mike Tyson's branded products for mold.
People assume it's safe because of guardrails that are in place by state enforcement, but when you actually look at the end result, I think that's up for debate, definitely.
In Colorado, health and safety warnings are confusing. Recalls can come months or years after marijuana is sold. And that feels unfair to companies that prioritize cleanliness, like this one. Workers in hairnets and white coats sanitize a machine that makes marijuana gummies.
What's that smell? It smells good.
Watermelon.
Justin Singer, the founder of this operation, says he went years without a state inspection. What kind of guy wants an inspection?
The kind of guy who wants an honest playing field. Like, I swear to God, professional sports would not be fun if there were no referees and one team was allowed to cheat while one team tried to follow the rules.
So he launched his own secret shopper study. He bought 15 different cannabis products from stores around Denver. He sent them to a lab. They found that half had molds and yeast present. Four of them had more than triple the state limit. Molds like aspergillus have been linked in rare cases to serious lung problems in cannabis users.
I consider Colorado weed today to be on par with New York street weed in 2008. In fact, I think the cartels probably cared more about their consumers than a lot of people here.
Colorado officials didn't comment on Singer's claims. They say there are robust requirements for marijuana companies to test product through state-licensed labs. But those testing systems can be gamed by growers, says Sean Opie with E4 Bioscience in Michigan. He's an expert in marijuana toxins. He says there's a lot at stake for large growers.
The desire to have a $250,000 harvest pass is very high.
Opie says it's a good idea for states to have a secret shopper surveillance program to randomly test the product that users are actually using. But he empathizes, too, with these cash-strapped states who are essentially on their own. Marijuana is federally illegal, so the Food and Drug Administration doesn't provide oversight.
I think without any doubt, having a national oversight would be very helpful because the patchwork of regulations leads to a variety of differences.
No two states are testing for exactly the same toxins. But marijuana growers in Colorado say, sure, the system isn't perfect, but it's better than buying weed anywhere else.
I think at this point in Colorado, you're dealing with the safest weed you can have in the United States.
Ethan Shaw runs a grow facility in Boulder County. There are a variety of marijuana products, he says, that fall into legal loopholes outside of state-regulated markets.
That is really where you need to be worried about heavy metals, mold, mildew, filth, all of these other things.
That's not enough for careful consumers like Thomas Mitchell, the Denver journalist. He lives close enough to walk to one of the city's 200 marijuana stores, but he drives to a place he trusts.
You're not going to keel over if you buy some cheap suspect weed, but 10 years down the road, maybe you develop a lung problem that someone who was smoking cleaner weed won't.
And unless it becomes fully legal and there are uniform safety standards and testing, it's buyer beware. For NPR News, I'm Ben Marcus in Denver.
This is NPR News.
The Trump administration is dismantling federal diversity efforts while some local and state governments continue right on.
Do not obey in advance. We don't yet know how these executive orders will actually affect you.
DEI in local government on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
We'll be right back.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Coming up, we'll try to make sense of a surprise NBA trade over the weekend that makes basketball star Luka Doncic a Los Angeles Laker.
The initial wave was people thought it was a hoax. In fact, the reporter at ESPN who broke the original news had to come forward and say, no, I haven't been hacked.
First the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. In Texas, National Guardsmen are now authorized to make immigration arrests after the state signed a memo of understanding with U.S. Customs and Border Protection. From Texas Public Radio, Gabriela El Corta Solario reports on how that could be a challenge for law enforcement.
Joseph Nunn, counsel at the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program, questions the legality of the agreement, which allows Texas National Guard soldiers to help detain and deport migrants.
This is a law enforcement issue. This is not a military problem. Soldiers, including the Texas National Guard, are trained to be soldiers. They're not trained to be immigration enforcement agents.
Texas Governor Greg Abbott had tried unsuccessfully to deputize state and local law enforcement to make immigration arrests, a concept the Trump administration supports. I'm Gabriela Alcorta Solorio in San Antonio.
Recovery crews have begun removing wreckage from the Potomac River 5 days after a mid-air collision over Washington, D.C. that killed 67 people. NPR's Joel Rose tells us authorities say they've recovered and identified the bodies of 55 people so far.
The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is leading the effort to remove the wreckage of the plane and helicopter from the river. Colonel Francis Parra is the commander of the Corps of Engineers Baltimore District. Parra says the recovery of the remaining victims takes precedence over everything else.
Should any remains be found during our process, an automatic work stoppage happens. So reuniting those lost in the tragic incident is really what keeps us all going.
Federal investigators are still trying to understand why the Black Hawk helicopter collided with a passenger jet that was attempting to land. It was the deadliest aviation disaster in the U.S. in more than two decades. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
Well, stocks finished lower across the board on Wall Street today. The Dow down 122 points. This is NPR. People are constantly coming up with ideas about what might be going on in other people's heads. As NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports, a new study suggests that the same thing is done by apes.
Luke Townrow is a researcher at Johns Hopkins University. He did a recent study that involved sitting face-to-face with bonobos that watched as another person hid a treat under one of three cups. Townrow would give the ape the treat, but only if he, Townrow, knew where it was. Sometimes Townrow got to see the treat being hidden, but other times his view was blocked.
So the idea here is that if bonobos could recognize when I did and didn't know something, they would tailor their communication so they would point more often and more quickly when I did not know where the food was hidden compared to when I did. And that's exactly what we found.
When he didn't know, they helped him out by pointing. The results appear in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Nell Greenfield-Boyce, NPR News.
President Trump's tariff threat has sent cryptocurrency prices on a roller coaster ride. Shares of Bitcoin fell below $100,000 today after Trump announced plans to start 25% tariffs on Canada and Mexico. Those tariffs, however, on imported goods from both countries have since been paused for 30 days as they work with the Trump administration to iron out their differences. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments, As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their client's best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Ari Shapiro in Panama City, a neighborhood called El Chorrillo, where you find sparkling new buildings used for Airbnbs alongside crumbling old structures, some of which have bullet holes in them, from the time that the Americans invaded this neighborhood and turned it to rubble in 1989.
They hid us under the bed, says Efrain Guerrero. He was only 5 years old then, but he says he still remembers what the U.S. called Operation Just Cause, when thousands of American troops came to his neighborhood in Panama 35 years ago. In this archival footage, which contains the sound of gunfire, you see families running from bullets, U.S. tanks rolling in the streets. President George H.W. Bush announced the goal to oust Panama's dictator, a drug lord named Manuel Noriega.
To safeguard the lives of Americans, to defend democracy in Panama, to combat drug trafficking, and to protect the integrity of the Panama Canal Treaty.
Today, another U.S. president is focused on this place. Panama is the only foreign country besides China that President Trump talked about in his inauguration speech. Speaking about the Panama Canal, Trump said, "We're taking it back." The new Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, was here today. We'll hear more about his visit in another part of the program. And the boy who hid under the bed from American troops when he was five is now a slim, tattooed man who leads walking tours through the neighborhood where he grew up, El Chorrillo.
What does this neighborhood mean to you? Why is this neighborhood so important to you?
For me, this is where you find Panamanian identity, Efrain Guerrero says. He calls his tour an immersive museum. At street corners, he pulls up images on his tablet, photos that show the same intersection 35 years ago, with U.S. troops in the streets or buildings on fire. As we walk, we pass murals depicting the assault. There's recent graffiti that says, "I don't forgive and I won't forget." An older man named Samuel Ricaute Castañeda joins us. He was 25 when the U.S. invaded.
Cuando llegué, escuchaba las detonaciones de la AK que nunca se me olvidan.
I'll never forget the sound of the bullets detonating right here, he says.
El plin, 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 destrampado todo el Chorrillo prácticamente.
He adds, all of El Chorrillo was practically destroyed.
So today, when you hear Trump talk about taking the Panama Canal, what goes through your head?
He pauses for a moment, and then his weathered face crumples.
Defender el país como en ese tiempo, yo también lo defendería. Yo lo viví y fue algo triste. No quisiera que volviera eso.
I would defend my country, he says. I don't want this to happen again. With all my heart, I don't want this to happen again. This is so sad. I would give my life for Panama. I don't want to, but since your president is kind of crazy, it could happen. Now, to be clear, President Trump has not said he intends to attack Panama. When a reporter asked a few weeks ago whether he'd consider using the military to take back the canal, Trump said this.
I'm not going to commit to that now. It might be that you'll have to do something.
Experts we talked to all said the U.S. is very unlikely to seek out a violent conflict with Panama. But to people living here who survived one American invasion already, those assurances aren't much comfort. Julissa Jaramillo remembers what the grown-ups told her when she was 16 years old.
Siempre nos decían que venía el lobo, venía el lobo.
They kept telling us, the wolf is coming, she says. Today, she sits in her tidy apartment, her silver hair in a bob. She says Operation Just Cause was a dividing line in her life. There was a before and an after. She considers it a massacre.
Es que yo dicen de que les decía que una causa justa, eso no fue una causa justa. Y que fue una, que fue una intervención, no fue, esto fue una invasión, porque ellos nos invadieron a nosotros.
They say it was a just cause. It was not a just cause, she says. They say it was an intervention, but it was an invasion.
And so today, have you paid attention to the things that Trump says? You laugh.
Es un Lucifer ese tipo. Porque nosotros estamos en el medio. Yo entiendo que nosotros los panameños estamos en el medio, el canal, entre China y Estados Unidos. Y nosotros quedamos, como tenemos el canal, nosotros quedamos en el, en la lucha, en la pelea de esos dos titanes.
She says, he's Lucifer. The Panamanians are caught between China and the U.S. We're in the middle of this fight, and since we have the canal, we end up caught between these two titans. While older people in this neighborhood still feel the trauma of what they lived through, a younger generation has also taken up the duty of remembering.
Like, it has been like so surprising to hear Trump talking about the canal. That was something that we weren't expecting, you know, in our 2025 bingo card.
Issa Asha is about to turn 22, and a couple days before we met him, he got a new tattoo. Two words in fine black capital letters, one below each collarbone. Prohibido olvidar, never forget.
And it's important for me, for everybody to also not to forget what happened, not to forget who we are, not to forget things like we fought for the canal and now they want to take the canal back.
And there's something else he wants people to remember. While Operation Just Cause lasted only a few days, killing hundreds of Panamanians and more than 20 U.S. soldiers, the troops that came to this neighborhood 35 years ago did not capture Manuel Noriega in the assault. He slipped out of the neighborhood and took shelter in the Vatican Embassy. On January 3, 1990, he surrendered to U.S. forces 2 weeks after the invasion of El Chorillo.
The South African government has hit back at President Trump's allegations that it's engaging in land grabs. Kate Bartlett reports from Johannesburg.
On Sunday, President Trump said the U.S. would cut aid to South Africa over what he termed the, quote, human rights violations it was committing against, quote, certain classes of people. More than 30 years after the end of apartheid, white South Africans, who account for over 7% of the population here, still own the vast majority of commercial farmland. South Africa passed a controversial law in January allowing the potential expropriation of land without compensation in some circumstances. But contrary to Trump's allegations, zero land has been seized. On Monday, the South African president's spokesman, Vincent Mgwenya, offered a fact check.
The recently adopted Expropriation Act is not a confiscation instrument, but a constitutionally mandated legal process that ensures public access to land.
Even the Democratic Alliance, a party in the country's coalition government which was against the law, expressed concerns about Trump's threats. Here's spokesperson Willie Okamp.
It is not true that the act allows land to be seized by the state arbitrarily, and it does require fair compensation for legitimate expropriations.
One of Trump's key advisors, billionaire businessman Elon Musk, who was raised in apartheid South Africa, waded into the argument on Monday, criticizing what he termed the country's, quote, racist laws. For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Around 10 million people were left in unhealthy air conditions after a series of fires in LA County last month. Among them, outdoor workers laboring in fields. And those workers have little to no protection from wildfire smoke. Nate Perez with NPR's Climate Desk reports.
A recent video circulating on social media showed farm workers in Ventura County picking strawberries under a blood orange sky. That smoke came from the Hughes Fire in North LA County.
That reddish light, it really, there's something primal that you really do, sort of your lizard brain recognizes that there's danger, you know?
That's Elizabeth Strader. She's the United Farm Workers National Vice President. She says Oxnard, a city in Ventura County, is surrounded by mountains and...
those little valleys and basins that that do tend to be such rich agricultural land are also places that are prone to being affected by wildfire smoke.
Most people don't realize how close LA is to the state's agricultural region, which supplies produce all over the country. Strader says just a little north of the city, and
suddenly you're surrounded by those green fields, those long rows, and you see the bodies of the workers out there affected by the smoke.
The air quality index was around 150 that late January day in parts of LA and Ventura County. That's where around 40,000 farm workers pick strawberries, citrus, and other produce this time of year. Michael Mendez has studied farm workers for nearly a decade. He says farm workers breathe in more toxic air because that work is similar to exercising.
They're breathing in more air because they're working fast. They're trying to get all the produce into the bins.
That's because some farm workers are paid by how many bins they fill with produce. So the more bins you fill, the more money you make. Yet, farm workers have little to no protection from wildfire smoke. Employers in California are legally required to provide N95 respirators to workers when the AQI reaches 150, but employees are not actually required to use them. Oregon and Washington are the only other states to also have this requirement. So when the Hughes fire broke out, labor unions and community aid groups scrambled to provide more than 21,000 respirator masks to farm workers. Jorge Toledano is with MyCop, a nonprofit that helps indigenous migrant communities. He says workers are worried about their health, but they know they have to feed their families, pay rent, and live. They have no choice but to work. When AQI levels hover between 100 to 200 on a smoky day, studies show that air pollution is equivalent to smoking a quarter to a half pack of cigarettes a day. And many farm workers in California already have pre-existing health disparities like asthma and other respiratory illnesses. Wildfire smoke can worsen those conditions. That's according to Mendez.
They're guide and enforcement for these individuals that are at the front lines of this climate crisis and are continuing to work throughout these wildfires.
A new law that allows farm workers to take sick days when the AQI reaches unhealthy levels took effect this year in California. But the UFW and MyCop say workers feel the economic pressure to continue working. Nate Perez, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Ari Shapiro at the edge of the Panama Canal. In other parts of the program today, we're hearing about Secretary of State Marco Rubio's visit here and his message about the canal. This morning, Rubio left for El Salvador, and he told reporters traveling with him that he is now the acting director of USAID, the Agency for International Development. NPR State Department correspondent Michelle Kellerman is traveling with the secretary. Thanks for joining us.
Nice to be here.
What did Rubio say about USAID?
Well, I mean, basically, he came out saying, accusing the USAID of having a history of ignoring the will of the State Department and deciding that they are, in his words, some sort of global charity separate from U.S. interests. He says the Trump administration is changing that. You know, employees have been sent home, and aid all around the world has been frozen and placed under review. And Rubio defended these actions, saying these are taxpayer dollars, and the Trump administration wants to make sure that the money it's spending abroad aligns with its goals. But it was really rather surprising, Ari, from someone who has spent a long time on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and backed aid programs in the past, particularly humanitarian aid and on human rights issues. But he says that for years he had concerns about some aid programs that are not aligned with U.S. goals, and he said that is coming to an end.
Rubio's first stop on this Latin America trip was here in Panama. As we've been reporting, Trump wants to take it back. That did not happen on this trip, but were any deals made?
Well, he called it a delicate issue because the president of Panama is a friend of America and a strong partner. That's how Rubio described President Mulino. But he said he did have some frank discussions about the canal and raised particular concerns about China. He said when the U.S. turned over the canal, it turned it over to Panama, not to China, but China has two big ports on either end of the canal. He complained about the Navy having to pay fees to go through it, and he says he wants that to change. But, you know, he didn't come out saying he made any particular progress. He said we will achieve potentially really good things. Time will tell. But he said he felt good about the discussion.
Immigration is dominating this trip. What agreements is Rubio hoping to make? Are countries cooperating with the Trump agenda on immigration?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Panama actually has done a lot to slow illegal migration, cutting back on movements through the Darien Gap by 90%. That happened during the Biden administration. And Rubio went to see a flight of migrants being sent back to Colombia today, 43 people, about 11 women, and one looked rather young. These are not migrants that came to the U.S. They are migrants that were going that perhaps could have come to the U.S. The U.S. pays for these flights, but remember, there's a freeze on aid. So Rubio said he actually had to issue a waiver to pay for that flight that he saw today.
That's NPR's Michelle Kellerman traveling with Secretary of State Marco Rubio. They are in El Salvador right now. Thanks a lot, Michelle.
Thank you.
All right, yeah, I know it's Super Bowl week, but we're going to talk basketball for the next few minutes because here were some of the initial reactions over the weekend to the blockbuster trade that the NBA just announced. Ain't no way. I'm sick right now. And WTF? Yep, that's what people were saying when they heard that the Dallas Mavericks' Luka Doncic, widely considered a once-in-a-generation talent, is now a Los Angeles Laker. In return, his fellow All-NBA player Anthony Davis is headed to Dallas. The deal caught players, fans, and sports writers off guard and has left them with a lot of questions. Jason Gay was one of the many sports writers baffled by the trade. He's a sports columnist for the Wall Street Journal and joins us now. Welcome back to the show, Jason.
Thank you so much. And, you know, it's even crazier than that. In addition to people being stunned by this, the initial wave was people thought it was a hoax. In fact, the reporter at ESPN who broke the original news had to come forward and say, no, this is I haven't been hacked. This is not a fake story. So that goes to show you how incredulous the NBA community was about this trade.
People were totally stunned. But as far as you can tell, like, why does this deal make any sense at all to the Mavericks and to the Lakers?
Well, Luka Doncic is one of the very, very few great superstar young players who you could build a franchise around. I mean, we're talking about he's on the shortest possible list for MVP candidates, for teams that could go to the finals every year. He's just a magnificent, magnetic player. And Dallas is basically at a crossroads where they have to make a decision as to whether or not they feel comfortable staying in the Luka Doncic business. 5 years, $350 million, a contract that he could sign as early as next summer. That's a lot of coin. That obviously sets a franchise into motion for the coming decade. And what you saw, I think, here was a little bit of cold feet on Dallas's part. Now, the outrage comes from the fact that the return doesn't feel equivalent. Dallas is getting back Anthony Davis, who's a wonderful player, 10-time All-Star, 31-year-old. But, you know, he's 6 years older than Luka. I mean, the idea is like these guys like Luka come along very, very rarely. And when you do have an opportunity to deal it, the sky's the limit for what you can ask. And the real wonderment is, what did Dallas ask for here?
Okay, so that is why a lot of people are calling this trade basically malpractice, right? Like, based on Luka's talent and global stardom. And I heard that even some fans took a coffin up to the Mavericks arena over the weekend for a fake funeral. Can you just talk about how big of a loss this is for Dallas specifically, for the fans, for the club?
I mean, Luka Doncic is the biggest athlete in Texas. And I'm saying that about Texas, the home of the Dallas Cowboys. Luka Doncic was somebody that if you lived in Dallas, you thought was going to be in your life for the next 20 years. And now he is on his way to Los Angeles, to LeBron James and the Lakers. I think they are completely shocked. And the sort of mock funeral you saw is basically Mavericks fans being completely pessimistic that the team has a plan that's going to get them anywhere near close to as good as they were when they had Luka around.
Yeah. Well, hey, I don't know much about basketball, but I do feel like I'm always hearing trash talk about how cities like Los Angeles or New York invariably land stars. Like, I mean, you know, are the Lakers just getting really greedy here because they already have LeBron James? What is bringing Doncic into the picture do for their future?
Well, believe it or not, LeBron James turned 40. So the Lakers are definitely in a situation where they need to make a bridge to the next generation. And yes, it's definitely true that historically, big market teams have commanded top players and gotten the interest from players. But that has faded a little bit. You know, we went through some real fallow periods with the New York Knicks, for example, where franchise, chaos scared people away from coming to New York City. But the Lakers, they just never seem to miss a beat. And just when you think that they're going to fall off relevancy, here they come roaring back again.
Okay, well, as controversial as this trade has been already, how will everybody be measuring the success of the trade?
I think for Dallas, it's very much a short-term question. They have to perform right now because they're older. Luka, there's no pressure for him to deliver immediately. This is a trade that was made for Los Angeles with the coming decade in mind and building upon his presence, not in just getting LeBron to the championship once more.
That is Jason Gaze, sports columnist for the Wall Street Journal. Thank you so much, Jason.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. From the NPR Wine Club, bringing people wines inspired by NPR shows. Whether purchasing a few bottles or joining the club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults.
All Harlem's in a rage, and not from blowing gauge. They've got a new type menace up there. He just blew into town. He's slim and coffee brown. His trademark is the call that fills the air. But Harlemites don't take alarm. He really doesn't mean you harm. He's only loaded up with jungle charm. no trees about. But listen to him shout, whoa! He's the Tarzan of Harlem. Big gals and small all answer to his call. Whoa!